The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. It's just turning 5 minutes past nine on this Tuesday, the 21st of March. How are you keeping today? Happy World Down Syndrome Day to you all. And if you want to get in touch with the programme, it's 086 60 25000. WhatsApps and texts, that number, 086 60 25000. You know you can give us a call as well, don't you? It's Caroline or Anne, you're taking your calls on 07491 25000. If you want to email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. We've got loads lined up for you to get involved in the conversation with. But also, you can raise your own issues, pass on your own stories to the numbers I've just provided. And you can also jump on your social media, your smart TV, your Fire Stick, your laptop, tablet, whatever it might be. Open up the YouTube app and watch us there, Highland Radio Ireland, or across our Facebook pages or directly off our website. Click Watch Live at highlandradio.com. Okay, let's have a look at the newspapers this morning. We'll start with the locals, the Donegal Democrat. Micheál Martin has vowed to bring those responsible for the killing of Private Sean Rooney to be brought to justice. The Taoiseach and Minister for Defence was speaking at Finnair Camp, where he inspected the troops from the 67th Infantry Battalion, who will be deployed to Golan Heights in Syria next month. On his first review of Irish troops for overseas deployments, the Defence Minister recalled the tragic killing of Private Rooney while on duty in the Lebanon in December. The Derry Journal this morning tells us that Inishowen's newly appointed defective concrete blocks facilitator plans to hold weekly clinics across the peninsula to reach out to community members who are in the process of applying for the redress scheme. Michelle Coyle officially joined Inishowen Development Partnership at the end of February and since then has hit the ground running, we're told. One of two DCB facilitators in the county, Michelle, is only too aware of the challenges the roles will bring, given the numbers of those affected. Let's go to the Nationals now. We'll start with the Irish Times. And a shocking story, really, and one I'm wondering if any of you out there have been affected by and wish to speak about. The first Irish study of people who were stalked or harassed found only half did not report incidents to An Garda Síochána. Only 42% went to the guards. For those who did report stalking or harassment, experiences were more likely to be negative than positive. So maybe that's why word gets around. Maybe that's why so few are coming forward. But I mean, being stalked or harassed is very, very stressful. It's a crime. But less than half of people who have been the victims of this go to the guards, and then their experiences aren't fantastic. A fear of not being believed because of awareness of deficiencies regarding Garda responses to gender-based violence, or a general lack of trust in the Garda regarding gender-based violence, were the main reasons why respondents did not report incidences. One respondent who reported their experience to Garda said they were rubbish, and another said that they said they couldn't do anything until they did something to me or one of my children. Now, obviously, this is taking the entire force as a whole. I would hope here in the Northwest, from interviews that we've done and people I've spoken to, that the response here would be more favourable from An Garda Síochána. And they've actively been on programmes like this to ask people to come forward if they are experiencing these things, and have outlined the supports they offer and the follow-up that they provide. So I would hope that things are better in this part of the country than perhaps elsewhere. But according to the report undertaken by Dr. Catherine O'Sullivan and Dr. Kira Saunton of University College Cork, in partnership with the Sexual Violence Centre Cork, a number of respondents described being victim-blamed, with one saying that, "I saw the Garda's face change when I said I'd slept with the person harassing me. He started making excuses on the harasser's behalf. He did not do enough and made me feel like I was just hysterical." So as I say, it's a very difficult thing to talk about. It's certainly a difficult thing to talk about publicly, but you can, under the protection of anonymity, if you wish to speak to us about that, if you've been affected by it or have an input into it, please let us know. 086 60 25000 or call us on 07491 25000. On to the Irish Independent. And glass, false nails, live insects. I think I'd prefer the live insects than the full snails. And a dirty plaster were among some of the foreign objects found in food here last year, according to the Food Safety Authority of Ireland. Foreign body contamination was a frequent complaint to the Food Safety Watchdog's advice line, which dealt with 7,363 queries and complaints in 2022. Nearly a third of the complaints from consumers related to unfit food, while more than a quarter of complaints were over poor hygiene standards. Among the objects commonly found in food were pieces of glass, wood, plastic, paper, metal, hairs, small stones, medicine tablets and insects. A live snail was also found in a pack of spinach, while live... Well, that's fresh, isn't it? I mean, that's right from the garden. While live maggots were found in fried chicken. I've nothing to say about that. A part of a disposable glove was found in a Rocky Road biscuit, and a dirty and possibly bloody plaster was found in curry. Consumers also reported finding a full snail in garlic cheese chips, a piece of glass in coffee beans, and metal shavings in chicken wings. Other complaints included meats not being completely cooked, mould on food products, food on sale past its sell-by date, and food served cold instead of hot. Now, obviously, this is a newspaper article, and there were, thousands of complaints, 7,363. Those are the extremes. What's the worst thing you've ever found in your food? Don't say carrots. No, but what is the worst thing you've ever found in your food? What's your worst food experience in that regard? I had a toastie made for me with a fly stuck into it once. I kind of haven't really touched one since. 086 60 25,000. What's your worst thing you've found in your food? Or your worst food experience in that regard? 086 60 25,000. I think I have this ability to compartmentalize. I'm sure I've found really nasty things, but I've managed to block the thoughts out. But share it with us. 086 60 25,000. A growing list of demands is being drawn up by TDs as the government seeks to shore up support ahead of the vote on the eviction ban tomorrow. This is the Irish Daily Mail. The Regional Independence Group issued a series of demands to Housing Minister Dara O'Brien, given their support will be crucial in securing a government victory. And I just don't think, and I don't really know the makeup of the Regional Independence Group, I could name a handful of them probably, but I just don't think they have the balls to vote against the government. I don't know why it is or what they have over them, and I don't mean in terms of anything controversial, but I just do not believe that they will wobble. Tipperary TD Michael Lowry told the Irish Daily Mail last night, "We made a number of requests that we felt should be highlighted. We just have to see what the government comes up with." He denied that this was about securing funding for the local constituencies, because that, if, and I think any of these agreements between independents or any grouping for that matter and the government, they should be made public, because we're talking about a housing crisis here. We're talking about potentially at least 4,000 people being chucked out of their homes on April 1st, right? Now, if this is about getting funding for a bridge or a footpath or a road, and that's how you support the government on this issue, there's something fundamentally wrong with politics in this country, isn't there? If it's about, say, I don't know, providing housing or some, maybe that's more palatable. But if they go with a shopping list that's not related to housing with a view to supporting the government in housing, the politics in this country is finished, really, as far as I'm concerned. I just think that would just be unbelievable. But anyway, he denied that the demands were about securing funding for their local constituencies. However, another TD told the Mail that a few million to go towards a local project would make them happy. So there it is. One TD is not interested in housing, according to the paper. They're interested in getting a few bob for the local community, and then they'll vote with the government. I mean, am I the only person that thinks that's fundamentally wrong? I naively thought they were making proposals only on housing or something, but they're actually going in with a wish list, some of them, according to this paper. What do you think about that? 086 60 25,000. As I say, I just think that is a terrible state of affairs for Irish politics. Mr. Lowry said the requests include tax relief for small landlords, increasing the band rate and eligibility criteria for a scheme to bring vacant properties back into use. Again, you know, if it's about amendments to improve the housing situation, I can kind of live with that. But one TD said he needed a few million for his local constituency to support the government. It's awful for the McMonagall family. Jasmine McMonagall, of course, was brutally murdered quite some time ago now. In fact, 2019, hard to believe. And that pain, unimaginable for her mother and family, the rest of the family, indeed. You can only imagine. You can't imagine, actually. I say you can only imagine, but you can't. And then they've waited this long for a trial in an effort to seek justice. Again, it must be just an awful, awful experience for them. And now the trial has begun. Possibly relief that it is about to begin and that, you know, justice can be found, if it can be found through this trial. Of course, I'm not in any way saying anything that might compromise the outcome of the trial. I'm speaking kind of generally. But then having to hear the brutal details, I'm not even fully comfortable in reading them out. But unfortunately, you know, we can't hide away from these things either. But for the next week or two, we all need to think on Jasmine's family and all those affected by this this awful crime as the trial goes on. Mother of two, Jasmine McMonagall, met a brutal death in her own home and was found by Gardaí in a pool of blood after she was strangled and had blows rained down on her by her on-off partner. A murder trial jury was heard, has heard. 32-year-old Richard Burke of Killigordon, originally from Donegal Town, was arraigned before the Central Criminal Court sitting in Monaghan yesterday. He pleaded not guilty to the murder of Ms. McMonagall at Forest Park, Killigordon, on January 4th, 2019, but guilty to manslaughter. The jury has been told they will hear evidence from two psychiatrists who agree that Mr. Burke was suffering from a mental disorder at the time of the killing, which substantially diminished his responsibility. Opening the case for the state, Anne-Marie Lawler, senior counsel, told the jury that Ms. McMonagall, 28, had been in a relationship with Mr. Burke on and off since 2016. She said Ms. McMonagall was at home with her two children on January 4th when she contacted Gardaí at around 4:20 a.m. with concerns about her own safety. Ms. Lawler said when Gardaí from Lifford attended the family home, a standoff ensued after Mr. Burke wielded a meat cleaver at members of the force. A crisis negotiator attended, and following a three-hour standoff, Gardaí forced the way into the property at 7:30 a.m. Ms. Lawler said Jasmine McMonagall was already dead by the time Gardaí entered the house, but thankfully her two young children were found unharmed. And thinking on those two young ones as well, but I know they'll be getting all the support that they need from the family there, the wider family. On to the Irish Sun this morning. The DUP will tomorrow vote against a key part of the British government's deal with the EU on post-Brexit trade rules. The UK Parliament is to debate and vote on the Stormont break, a key part of the Windsor framework. It enables Britain to stop new EU laws from applying to goods in Northern Ireland if requested by a third of Stormont MLAs. But DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson has confirmed his party will scupper it. He said last week, "I indicated that while significant progress had been secured in the Windsor framework across a number of areas, it does not deal with some of the fundamental problems at the heart of our current difficulties. It's our view that there remains key areas of concern which require further clarification, reworking and change." That being said, there are enough numbers, aren't they, to see that through the Houses of Parliament. So the DUP can oppose it, but it won't stop it, so they'll have to come up with another plan of action. Finally, in the Irish Daily Mirror, energy credits worth hundreds of millions of euro are set to return for everyone in the country after a new windfall tax law is green-lighted this morning. Eamon Ryan will ask the government to sign off on legislation today that will pave the way for them to collect up to 600 million euro from energy companies this summer. The money will make its way back into bill payers' pockets in late autumn, we are told. How much of it, I don't know. A senior government source last night told the Irish Mirror the windfall gains measures will consist of two parts: a temporary solidarity contribution based on taxable profits in the fossil fuel production and refining sectors, and a cap on the market revenues of some generators in the electricity sector. Again, as I say, how much of that we will see, we'll have to wait and see. Now, 249 people over the age of 65 in Donegal are awaiting home support. Donegal has the second highest waiting time in the state, and that figure represents a tripling in the waiting list in this part of the world, I believe. These details were compiled by Home and Community Care Ireland. Rory Cleary is chairperson of Dunlow Active Retirement, and he joins us now. Rory, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Greg.
So just so everybody is clear, because for some people this hasn't come into their lives yet, what is home care support, home support?
Well, I think that one of the things that a lot of people will think about, even at a younger age, as they get older, that there are going to be problems. You know, there could be medical problems, etc. And when you go into hospital, and when you need to be released from the hospital, then there is a very good possibility that as you get older, you're going to require to have some sort of home care package in place where some professional or professionals come in, whether they be nurses, whether they be home care, who will come around to do things for you in the house, so that you can go back into your house.
Because, and I presume there's a variant in that level of care, isn't there? That some would require very little support, others might require a bit more.
Absolutely. I mean, I was speaking to somebody last week whose mother fairly recently had broken a hip. Now, her mother was 96 and she went into hospital. And obviously, at that sort of age, coming back out and looking after yourself is going to be very, very difficult. So the level of care that she needed was very, very high. Now, there was a care package put in place, but the problem was it took 2 weeks after she was released before the carers started coming into the house. Now, that immediately causes a problems for family because it's expected at that stage that who else is going to look after them apart from the family. Now, I think that in the sort of rural areas that we live in, we're fairly lucky in that a lot of people are employed locally. And so they're more caring towards the staff. And so they will say, OK, we'll take an hour here, an hour there, etc. But it is very, very difficult when you're released from hospital and you have some form of disability from the operation or whatever it is that you've actually had in the hospital.
And before we talk more about, obviously, the impact on people and the community, I have to make the connection, of course, as well. This is part of the problem with overcrowding at Letterkenny University Hospital, because they will only presumably discharge someone when measures are in place for their care. And we do know that at times there can be 20, 30 people awaiting discharge for a number of reasons, but amongst them are family not available to provide care or support, or no home support packages available. So we are talking about one area, of course, but it does also affect the acute hospital. And what are people's, when we say there's a waiting list, does that mean some never get it, or they have to wait a long time to get the support? And also, I presume we have no problem. Can you hear me okay? Right, okay. Rory is just going to check on something there. He'll be back with us shortly. Right. No, Rory, what I was going to ask you there is that, you know, do people get the home care? We're talking about a waiting list. Does that mean they have to wait a certain amount of time or they don't ever receive it?
Sorry, Greg, I'm obviously having a problem in hearing what you're saying there. Could you just repeat the question?
I'm just saying, do people get the care that they're required on this waiting list, or does it never arrive?
Well, right, okay. So, yeah, more often than not, what I've heard, the care does arrive. But as you say, one of the problems is, first of all, is that the people become, it's a horrible word that people use, but they use bed blockers. And as you say, they can't be released from hospital because they're not well enough and they need care when they get out. Now, there has been talk, and it is talk at the moment, I believe, that in Letterkenny Hospital, or in the area of Letterkenny Hospital, they're going to build a 100-bed extra place where people who need the care, but the care provisions are not in place, can actually use that facility so that it frees up the main beds for people who really need to get in because of medical problems themselves. And hopefully that will solve a lot of the problem. But that's only talk at the moment. And how long are we going to be before that actually gets into place?
Yes, well, we got an update not too long ago, and hopefully that does come to fruition quickly. But of course, people also want to be cared for at home or in their communities, so that's not going to fix every problem. And also, I'd imagine, Rory, unless we are recruiting more home care staff, the current great staff we have are going to be spread more thinly, which is an awful lot of pressure on them and unfair on the person receiving the care.
Absolutely. And, you know, even at the moment, somebody else told me that they get care people coming in, but they're only given 15 minutes or 20 minutes to deal with the patient. And not only that, but the family have to get things in place so when the carers come in, they get the job done as quickly as possible. I mean, these carers obviously have a very, very difficult job, but they're not really given enough time as well. And again, as you say, it's taking on extra people in that position. It's something that's always worried me. As you get older, and I'm just turned 70 last year, and you know, you think to yourself, what is going to happen with the years as you get further down? As you can tell from my accent, I'm not from this area at all, so I have no family here. But if I was to go into hospital or my wife was to go into hospital, then we don't have family who can help. Now, to be fair, the people here are fantastic. The local people are fantastic. The Irish people are known as that for that. And it's really good that they would come and help. But it really needs to be more resources need to be put into the home care packages.
And also, we owe older people who built this country for us and laid the groundwork on which we live now, we owe them that. We don't want to live in a society that older people feel like a problem or a burden. There's absolutely no reason why that should be the case. This is down to a lack of planning for many, many, many years, and also a lack of resources and will being put into this sector right about now. And, you know, this is not just about the care of a person. This is how this makes them feel as well. It's not right what we do.
Yes, absolutely. I think the other thing that a lot of people worry about as they get older is monetary wise, and you know they are concerned that they're one becoming a burden on their family, two have they got enough money to pay for these carers? They're going to have people coming into their homes that they don't know, but I mean the carers are fantastic people, etc. And so you know generally it is a great problem. And then, of course, as you get older, you've got the situation as if people cannot be coped at home, you have to start looking at care homes, etc. And that's the last thing that people want to do because they want to be in the community. They want to be in the home. They want to stay in the home. Apart from anything else, it's going to save the government a lot of money by having people in their homes rather than being in a home or whatever. Mm. So it is very important that these facilities or more monetary items are put into the care homes, care facilities within the house.
And you, it's not an immediate problem now, maybe as much, but you keep mentioning the word home and people being in their home. The problem that's going to be perhaps for future generations, maybe sooner rather than later, is more and more people are renting and may never own a home. And we don't really have a plan. What do you do in that regard when someone can no longer pay rent or the house is too big for them? We don't have alternative accommodation and we're not planning for that. So we are switching to sort of almost like a rental nation, like other nations in Europe, for example. But we don't have any plans. So that's going to amplify the concerns and worries people have as they advance into their older years. They don't have the home that they, you know, that that many people just take as I want to be in my home.
I want to be in my home, exactly. And in the long term, it is cheaper for the government to have them in their own home rather than to have to look to put them into care homes, something like that, or people having to give up jobs to look after their relatives, their mothers or their fathers or whatever. And, you know, that is another problem that can happen. One of the things that I think we lack over here, one is homes, especially for older people. I know that particularly in Letterkenny, they're looking at the present moment of building homes specifically built for older people. And also there should be more look, or people should look more into what they call sheltered accommodation, where you can have your own flat, but it is within a complex mm-hmm. where there are carers on site all the time. So all these sort of things need to be looked at.
And the willingness is there because I've spoken to older people living in very large houses, 3 or 4 bedroomed houses. And they approached the council and said, can you find us a 1-bedroomed bungalow? We are in a family home that will look after a large family. And they wanted the council to facilitate that. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it? To find them or build them a property that is closer to services, for example, or the hospital that suits their needs, and free up this 3 or 4 bedroomed house for a family for the rest of their lives. But unfortunately, we don't have that level of joined up thinking. And Rory, there's another. Go ahead.
To be fair, I think that there are that a lot more discussions going on at the moment, particularly as it always happens in Dublin, you know, around that area, where there are more of these places being built, which are specifically for the older people. Yeah. And I think that that is good. But you're right. Yes.
Better than late than ever, because this conversation I talk of was 4 or 5 years ago, and that was if they had, not saying they should do anything off the back of what we're talking about, but if they listen to the public, if the decision makers listen to the public, a lot of the solutions are there. And very finally, Roy, I want to talk about another group of people, and that are families under great deal of pressure now. They've got their own children. They've got maybe both adults in the house working, you know, struggling with bills and all that type of stuff. And that scenario you talked of earlier, where an older person or even not an older person needs additional care, a great deal of pressure on them to provide it because it's family and stuff. But the realities of life means it's very difficult for them. And the lack of home care packages or home support is adding greater pressure onto the children as well, who are in an impossible situation a lot of the time.
Absolutely. You know, if you think about it, it is a very awkward situation for people, for families, and the worry that they would be going through and having to rely on, you know, sort of you have to get people together, families, friends, etc., and help out each other. And it's not the right sort of thing. And I think that, you know, as we say, there ought to be more monetary items put into the home care situation, etc.
Fine, exactly. Yeah. And again, it's like so much we talk about on this program. Spending the money saves the state money in the long run. You spend a fiver and you save a tenner. You know what I mean? We with proper planning and proper decision making, it's actually less of a burden on the state's finances. And that's what always confuses me as to why progress is so slow. Rory, it's been lovely speaking to you. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much indeed. No problem. And enjoy the rest of your day, and best wishes to you and your partner. Right, okay. Any views on that? 086 60 25,000. You know that's the WhatsApp and text number, don't you? If you want to give us a call to 074 91 25,000. Now, do you remember yesterday we were contacted by a member of the public who was at Now Dock in Carndonagh, and we didn't mention Carndonagh at the time to give them an opportunity to reply. They were at Now Dock at the weekend and they wouldn't accept a card payment. It had to be cash. They asked, does anyone know why this is? As we had to go to the town and get cash from the ATM. So as we committed to, we endeavoured to get an answer, and it is as follows. Care Doc have provided Now Doc with some up devices to accept card payments. We are aware that Carndonagh have been having some issues with their sum up devices, but this is being looked into and it will hopefully be resolved soon. So effectively, the machine that reads your cards weren't working in Carndonagh, but they're working on it to get them working, if that all makes sense. So into the future, hopefully, you'll be able to pay by card there if you have to call in. Right, Chelsea joins us now. Chelsea, thanks very much for doing this. I think this is really important and gets a good message out there. Chelsea, good morning to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. You're not too well, I would say, because scammers have been able to access your Revolut account and you've lost a ton of money. Well, it seems a ton of money to me anyway. Tell us what happened.
So basically it started with a notification through my Revolut account last Monday. It said that someone had logged in. So I went in and put my code in for my Revolut, and I thought nothing of it. So then it went to Thursday and I got a phone call from what I thought was my Revolut account. And they knew everything about me. They knew all my details. They knew where I was from. And they told me that my account had been hacked. They said that it was through my emails. So basically they told me that they were going to try and secure whatever funds that I had in my Revolut. And I told them, like, I don't really use Revolut, so it's not a big loss to me. But they said, so is your Revolut connected to your AIB or your bank? And I said, yeah, it is. And that would be my concern because I get my wages paid through my AIB account. So basically then they said that AIB was going to call me back. So that fella hung up and another fella rang me back. No, and he claimed that he was AIB and that my AIB account was going to be put into a block and no one would be able to get in or out of it. So he said, because of this, the hacker that was in my Revolut account is in my AIB account and he won't be able to get out of it for 12 hours. And
now, just before we carry on that conversation, yeah. Both of these guys are scammers.
Yeah. Yeah, they right, both okay. are. They were both yeah, playing
both
the game.
Scammers,
yeah.
right. It's very complex.
But I, at the time, I obviously thought that I was talking to...
Yes, for sure. I can see
people.
I can see why, yeah.
Yeah, so basically they said that my account was going to be unblocked, but the hacker wouldn't be able to get out of my account for 12 hours. And I asked him, well, what happened? That's in there. And they said, look, we're going to keep an eye on it and whatever is taken from you will be put back in your account. So basically, the AIB hung up and the Revolut boy rang me back and he said that my Revolut was safe. I was on the phone to him on mute for over an hour while he said he was doing security checks. And in the end, he said, look, your Revolut account is safe now, but your AIB isn't. So they got me basically transfer some of my savings from my AIB account to my Revolut so that if I needed money, it was there.
Yeah.
And that it would be more secure there as the hacker was still in my AIB.
So they're
account.
Saying, look, we've made sure your Revolut account is safe. It's get safe. Your money out
yep.
of the unsafe AIB account yep. into Revolut while we work on shifting the hacker out of AIB.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So then it actually took my sister to ring me and say, Chelsea, something's not right. It was 2 days of being on the phone with them. And she said, Chelsea, something's not right here. You need to go onto your AIB. And your Revolut. So we did. And basically over 13,000 euro was taken out of my Revolut to a crypto app called Binance.
Oh, wow.
And that's when we kind of knew what I got myself into.
That is absolutely heartbreaking. 13,000 euro
yeah.
of savings. And you have to work. That's a lot of earnings after tax before it
yeah.
actually becomes savings. That's actually heartbreaking, Chelsea. Can
yeah.
we go back
yeah.
to the start? What was the original contact then that started this whole chain of events?
It was an 085 number from Dublin. But now when we try to contact that number back, it's actually an IVF clinic in
yeah.
Dublin.
They've just cloned that number. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it said, the original text said there's been some unusual activity on your account, or what did the original text say?
It said that it wasn't a text message, it was actually through my Revolut app.
Yeah.
It was that someone had logged in to my Revolut.
And that just started the ball rolling. And they dedicated yeah. an awful lot of time to this as well. They had different people
lawyers.
From different banks. I mean, anyone would have, yeah. Once the conversation started, I think, Chelsea, anyone would have fell for that because
yeah.
it's just... That level of complexity is what we don't normally hear of, Chelsea.
Yeah, no, they're used to what they're doing anyways.
And what about, I mean, you've effectively, this is just a reality, it's no reflection on you, you've kind of really effectively approved all of these transactions by accident, effectively.
No. They were in my Revolut account approving it themselves.
Ah,
I didn't
right, I get
approve
you.
Of anything.
Right, so
I just moved the money over.
I get you. They had got access to that at that point and they were
able to
draw the money over.
Yeah, they've been in my Revolut account all week and I can see that now. And they're still in my Revolut account. So they went in then and approved of the transactions.
What are Revolut and what are AIB saying to you?
So AIB... can't do anything. They've tried to help me, but because the money was moved over, it's out of their hands. But as for Revolut, they are not helping. I've shown them the proof that there has been another account in my app, and they're saying it's all my fault. I shouldn't have moved my money over, that I approved of it. Mm. Even with the proof that the other phones in my account, they are doing nothing to help. Absolutely nothing.
Wow, this is devastating for you, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Revolut are washing their hands. They are not working with you on this at all then, so there's very little hope for you.
Basically, up until last night, the transaction was pending. It hadn't fully gone through yet. I had asked Revolut, please freeze this payment until at least you investigate it, but they said, no, we're not doing that.
Wow.
We can't
do
that.
They had an opportunity to... they were speaking
yeah.
to the account holder... and that was still pending. They had an opportunity to
yeah.
freeze it and they didn't.
No, they wouldn't do anything for me. And now it's completed, it's gone through. And they're still saying, oh, well, there's nothing we can do. It's your own fault.
Wow, that's just awful, Chelsea. I mean, you're saying at this point now, you know, if you're on Revolut, get off it. That's what your feelings are.
Definitely. Yeah, they are not helping. Even if you look up now, the amount of people that is going on about Revolut is shocking.
And, I mean, normally at this point, there's somewhere to turn. But even if you notify the Gardaí, and I'm sure you have, or you will,
yeah.
I mean, they might look at it as a crime, but the chances of recovering this money at this stage are non-existent. Like, I mean, this is an awful loss to you, Chelsea.
Yeah, it is. I have no hopes at this stage of getting it back. I just want people to be aware of it at this stage now.
All right, Chelsea. Well, listen, we all have to learn. But I mean, at the end of the day, this is so complex. How many of us would have spotted it in time? Because what they've gone through to sort of made out they were helping you, that they found a problem, that were assisting you all the while behind the scenes. What they're the ones actually scamming you. It's terrible. Yeah. It's terrible, Chelsea. But listen, thanks for helping us spread the word. I appreciate that. It's no comfort to you whatsoever, but I do know that you've gone public on this so as to avoid other people suffering the same fate.
Yeah.
All right, Chelsea. Again, I'm really sorry you've gone through it. There's nothing I can say other than that. All right, Chelsea. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
All right, take care. Chelsea Farrell there. Lost 13,000 euro. Just, I mean, I think any of us could have fallen for that. The one thing I will say, and I was in the room with someone when this happened to them, and it just happened to be after a transaction. So it looked legit, and they almost lost 1,000. I think it was about 1,000, but managed to stop it quick. Is the scammers now can clone numbers, excuse me, and they can clone a number in a way that it appears in your thread. So if you open up your SMS on your phone with your lending institution or your credit union or Revolut, you have a thread of texts that says, you know, it could be, you know, your six-digit code to approve the transaction, six-digit code to approve the transaction. You transferred 20 euro to whoever. And then in that thread, the scammers can make this message appear. So you open it up. It is from Revolut. Now, of course, further investigation will show you that it's from a different number, a clone number. But they can put these SMSs in the thread of your lending institution. And once they've done that, and once they shock you enough, then they kind of can have you. So just be extra, extra, extra careful. And we really thank Chelsea for helping us to try and spread the word there. It's very, very much appreciated, though it's no comfort to her, I don't think, at this point. Because, I mean, to accumulate 13,000 euro, you have to work so hard, and you have to earn much more than the 13 to get that into the bank too. That's the other side of it. So many hours of graft, you know, to get that money. Now, you may have heard reports or read reports that Irish people are among the biggest users of cocaine in the world. This according to a new report by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime. Ireland trailed only Spain, the Netherlands and Australia for cocaine use and consumed the drug at the same rate as the US and Austria in joint fourth highest place globally. This effectively means that just short of 1 in 40 people in Ireland reported using cocaine the previous year, 2.4%. Now, I presume that's of the general population, right? So if you, I'll ask actually Stephen McLaughlin, Clinical Director at White Oak Centre in Muff, who joins us. Stephen, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning.
I'm not sure if this is, you know, between ages, but if you were to pull out the people least likely to take cocaine, so very young people maybe, or people over a certain age, that percentage probably increases quite dramatically.
Yeah. The way I would, I suppose, have experienced it working here at White Oaks is that we almost assume that anyone under the age of 40 coming in for addiction issues, that cocaine is pretty much likely to feature along, maybe with alcohol. Alcohol would still be the most prevalent cause of addiction. But cocaine, certainly over the last 7 or 8 years, I'm working here about almost 11 years. And for myself and my colleagues, we've noticed a very significant increase in the number of young people, basically between the age of 20 and 40, who are coming in with cocaine addiction.
I'm sure this is down to sort of popular cultural influences and every TV show that you watch, you know, they're snorting cocaine, and very often they don't present the negative elements of that. I kind of get the feeling that cocaine has kind of moved a little bit into the realm of cannabis, where you'd have a lot of people that say, look, it's just like drink. It's just for a night out. It's not a hard, serious, bad drug. I'm not suggesting that for a second, but I just wonder amongst younger people if that's the perception. And then, of course, once they're hooked, they're hooked.
I think certainly it has become much more normalized. In previous times, it may have been seen as something used more exclusively by those who were better off, perhaps those who worked in high-pressure jobs, etc. That has all gone. Cocaine use is now much more prevalent and, as I say, much more normalized among people of all kind of age and social groups. And I think a lot of that is down to the easy availability of the drug.
Can you talk to me about that, what you've learned from people you speak to about the availability and the widespread availability of it? Presumably then people see it as very easy to get your hands on.
Yeah, well, very much so. I mean, anecdotally speaking to people who come for treatment, they would certainly be of the view that, as someone said to me, maybe a wee bit flippantly, it's easier to get a bag of cocaine on a Saturday night in Letterkenny than it is to get a pizza. Now, that may be slightly tongue-in-cheek, but what they were saying is that when people are out and about, young people are socialising, there is very little difficulty in being able to get cocaine. I think it's also because the fact that we may have this perception that it's been supplied by these gangs and gangsters and people sort of in dark corners. The sad reality is that it's people's neighbours, it's people working in ordinary jobs who are doing this as almost a sideline because it's quick, easy money. And therefore, it's becoming easier, much easier for people then to avail of cocaine when they're out socialising. And very often it's friends supplying to friends. You know, people who perhaps have a drug addiction themselves and who are then able to feed that addiction by also supplying to friends within their network.
I'm not saying it's the reason, but I do wonder, does it contribute? And I've said it numerous times over numerous years, over the course of what we're seeing is an increase here, that whilst we make alcohol, you know, less attractive through price and what have you and whatever, at the same time, we should have been recognising that younger people who want a buzz or a high at the weekend and booze is too expensive, and they are going to take something, that they will go for something that's cheap on the street, hand-to-hand interaction, and away you go. Like, I just wonder if, you know, a lot of policy, we drove people from drink to the likes of these drugs, but we didn't recognise that in advance and didn't sort of say, right, we also need to be making sure that we address the inevitable drugs problem. As I say, I'm not saying it's the cause of it all, but I really do, and I have felt for a long time, that it is a big contributor.
Yeah, but in a sense that can almost take the view that it's inevitable that people are going to become to some extent dependent on substances of one kind or another.
No, what it means, yeah. But I'm talking.
Stephen,
just to be clear,
certainly substance.
Yeah, but to be clear, Stephen, I am talking about those that do. The majority of young people actually don't drink up until a certain age. But I'm on about those that are inclined to drink, and it becomes incredibly expensive. It's within that cohort, they will look for another alternative. There's a correlation there.
In terms of cost, I mean, the reality is at present it's about €100 a gram for cocaine. That's not exactly an inexpensive kind of habit to develop. We would have young people come in here perhaps who are earning good money, you know, maybe involved in the building trade, could be earning in excess of €1,000 a week, but yet by a Monday morning, they have nothing to show for it.
Right, okay, fair enough. I accept that. You know, I mean, you're the expert.
It may have got maybe more accessible, more available, But I don't think that necessarily translates into being cheaper than something like alcohol.
So the driver would not necessarily be the financial element of it. Okay, I get that, Steve, and I accept that. Of course I do. What are the... How does this addiction impact people? What do you see in them when, you know, like, how is their life?
Quite often, either they themselves or their family members would seek help when the person is finding it difficult to manage their lives. Quite often, the first impact is the breakdown of trust, whether it's with a partner, with a family member. They don't know where they are. Money seems to be missing. They're spending a lot of money. They're being secretive in their behavior. So there's a breakdown of trust with people close to them. The other thing that's noticeable is that a person's mental health begins to suffer because they become easily agitated. They get easily stressed by the smallest of things. They're no longer dependable. They maybe start to miss work. And then there's physical symptoms of it where, you know, they're not sleeping properly. They're restless. You know, they have mood changes. Those are the signs that people close to them usually pick up fairly quickly. And then it develops from that, particularly if a person develops a serious addiction whereby, you know, they can get involved and end up running debts. And we would have particularly family members coming in here telling us of the kind of sums of money that they're paying off to dealers because their son, their daughter, their husband, whoever, has got involved and has ran up significant debts that they're unable to pay off. There's the worry, the fear for family members because quite often the dealers then aren't just going to stop with the individual who's using the drugs, but they will demand the money of whoever is close or attached to the user. So there's a whole series of ripple effects that stem from the person's usage.
Yeah.
And it's not by any means, you know, a harmless drug or people talk about using it recreationally. That's far from the truth because, you know, once a person becomes dependent on using cocaine in order, you know, as a stimulant to derive some kind of pleasure, the simple fact of the matter is that they will build up a tolerance, which means that they will have to use more and more of the drug to get that original buzz that they would have had. And so it's a greedy drug in that sense.
Yeah.
It takes more and more of the person.
All right, okay. And listen, I mean, obviously, we don't want to see reductions in police drug units within Longada, Síochána and what have you, as we try and deal with this problem. Stephen, listen, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I wish we were speaking under different circumstances, but it's great to get the views of an expert. Thank you. Stephen McLaughlin, Clinical Director at White Oaks Centre in Meath.